Media Masters with Paul Blanchard.
Welcome to Media Masters, a series of one-to-one interviews with people at the top of the media game. Today I'm joined by Carla Buzaci, Managing Director of trend forecasting company WGSN. Carla spent 15 years in journalism and was founding editor-in-chief of the Huffington Post UK. During her time there, she won Editor of the Year twice in a row at the Online Media Awards. She's also a regular pundit on TV and radio, popping up on shows such as the Today programme, Lorraine and Newsnight. Carla, thank you for joining me.
My pleasure.
So, Carla, it says here that you're MD of the world's number one trend forecasting company. What exactly is that? Do you use like a crystal ball or something? I don't even know what that is. Just tell me what you do.
Okay, so we have clients in over 100 countries around the world, and we basically help them understand what their consumer today and tomorrow wants, and then how to create the very best products and experiences for that consumer.
So how on earth do you do that?
So I am very privileged to have a crack team of forecasters, and they're a mix of journalists, data scientists, designers, come from all walks of life. But what all of them have in common is this ability to really understand the field they're in and therefore be able to predict what will be big in that field. And that might be in 2 years' time, but also in an ever-increasingly fast-paced world, what's going to sell and what do consumers want to actually purchase. Purchase tomorrow.
And is it a bit like, you know, sometimes you see Tomorrow's World from the 70s where, and you look back and you think, oh God, they got that so wrong. And then other times they get it right.
Yeah.
How on earth can you be held to account?
Well, I like to think that we get it right more than we get it wrong. And we're held to account by the fact that clients keep on using us. So if we weren't getting it right, then they wouldn't be using us. WGSN's been around for 20 years. So the art of forecasting is pretty well honed now. And what we have, which is very different to other walks of media life, are people who really live and breathe a very specific field the whole time. So I have a team who are 100% dedicated to denim. So they're at every denim trade show. They're in the factories. They're working with brands. They are wherever people are wearing denim in large quantities. And they're looking at that and they're looking for little shifts. So maybe a leg length changing or a flare shape changing or a shade of denim or indigo changing. And they look at all those little shifts to be able to project where the big shifts will take place.
And how do you monetize that then? So let's say that the leg length is changing on some denim jeans, as you've just said. So who is your client there? Is that someone who manufactures jeans that's trying to anticipate that demand change? Because I imagine the economic costs must be quite a lot if you get it wrong.
Well, I mean, the economic costs of what we do are high because if you look again, especially in kind of consumer media right now, everyone's kind of slashing costs and want fewer staff to do that. Ours is intensive in terms of people. Now, we do use data. It's a very important part of what we do. But the expertise of the people is the really valuable thing. And therefore, we need a team and we need a team across the globe because you can't forecast trends if you're just sitting in one city or one country. But we sell by subscription. So manufacturers, as you pointed out, are a big base of that, but also retailers and brands as well, who are going to be making sure that the products that, you know, we have in our wardrobes or we have in our kitchen cupboards or in the hotels we go to or the films that we watch, all of those are products in a certain way, and all of those brands behind them and the retailers need to understand what trends are going to be big.
And sometimes does it kind of circumvent cause and effect that you'll predict a trend and then because one of your clients gets behind it, that creates the trend in a sense?
It's a question I get asked a lot and I think it's a very valid question.
Sorry,
it's not an original question. I've had that one before. But I think there's a it could happen, but that would be to grossly underestimate consumers because, I mean, you think of the number of trends that we've seen are really big in stores and then they don't sell and it gets to the end of the season and it's increasingly marked down. Our job is to absolutely understand the direction of change for the consumer, and that's how we work out what products or colours or experiences that they will want in future years.
So is it purely consumer-centric in a sense that it's products and like you said, they're staying in hotels and so on and so forth, or do you predict the future in other ways like politics and journalism and media and so on?
So we use all of those as signifiers for what we do. So one of my favourite days at WGSN, shall we say, one of the weirdest days, or maybe one of the most typical days, was it was the day after the presidential election in the US, and I was in New York, and, you know, Trump had just come to power, and, you know, that has an impact on our forecasts. You know, politics plays a very important part in how consumers are going to feel and what they want. But it was also a day when one of our clients wrote in to complain that we didn't have enough prints for baby socks. And, you know, that's really important. If you're selling socks to mums and dads with young children, you need to have lots of prints for it. And, you know, they look to us for that as well. So all of the cultural and societal changes that happen have an impact on consumers and therefore what they will want to spend their money on. Do we forecast politics? That is not an area that we have gone into.
Thank goodness. I don't think anyone can these days, can they? The whole thing's gone bananas, frankly.
Yeah.
How much of it is systematised? I mean, if you look at, say, the film Minority Report with Tom Cruise, I imagine other people have said that to you as well. You know, is some of it automated where you've got these three people floating in the pool and there's the various balls that say it's murder and so on? But is there, you know, I obviously exaggerate, but is there a part of it that's systematised so that you, even though you don't know what the answer is, you know about how you're going to go about getting that answer?
There is. If you came into our offices, it would look very lo-fi. I think we might be the largest purchaser of post-it notes globally. There is an awful lot of post-it noting that goes in into the process, but the process is well honed, as I said. So twice a year, all of our experts come together for what we imaginatively call Trends Day. And this is not beautiful presentations that we would want the world to see. These are presentations that are very internal, they're very raw, and they are the experts from that area of the field and that area of the world who are talking about the things that they are seeing right now. And after we've done that, we have a 7-week process where we debate, where we do extra research, where we argue. And that is the systematized process that we go through, that we've done so many times now, that we know at the end of that, we will have a 2-year out forecast, which is then for our clients to use. And then we get much more specific over that 2 years as we feed in new research, as we feed in new data points, as we see changes that are happening in the market, till we get to the point where we're saying these are the trends that literally will be selling tomorrow.
And how did this way of business come about? Because you mentioned there about keeping in touch with, say, the globalised media. That was probably something you couldn't do as effectively as now, say, 30 years ago.
Yeah, I mean, if you think about social media and influencers and how trends track very fast across social media, none of that existed when WGSN first launched 20 years ago. Back then, trend forecasting was done in these really big books that were sold at trade shows, and they would have colour palettes and fabric swatches in them.
Very old
school. And Mark Wirth, who was the founder of WGSN, looked at that and thought, well, why don't we put this on the internet, which 20 years ago was still quite a new revolutionary platform. But we have massively changed since then. The world has changed. Our client base has changed. Back then, it was very much for the fashion industry. And now we serve, I think it's about 23 different industries through our trend forecasting platforms.
And this might be a commercially confidential answer, so you feel free to not answer, of course, but what's your ratio of what you get right to what you get wrong? Because some things ultimately are unforeseeable, are they?
Yeah.
The Donald Rumsfeld so-called unknown unknowns.
And that's why we have to be very quick to react to emerging trends as well. So although we'll do our big 2-year out forecast, which is at a very macro level, we also then need to be able to react to small trends that come and go very quickly. And I think one of the reasons that trend sometimes comes with negative connotations is because, you know, we also live in a world of fads. But fads can be very commercially important as well for a brand. I mean, if you look at the fidget spinner every parent, I think, hates them. But if you were selling to children, if you were a toy shop and you didn't get the fidget spinner in really, really quickly, well, then you missed out on a huge market. But you also needed to get rid of them quite quickly because, you know, it was here and then it was gone again. But interestingly, the Rubik's Cube also had a surge during that time as well because it was kind of reintroducing a very tactile toy for children, and it was making them use their brains and use, you know, all their digits. And although the fidget spinner kind of came and went, the kind of toys around it are still selling very well. So it's our job not only to get the big macro trends right, but also when we spot something that's moving quickly, tell our clients about it so they can respond to that, but also tell them when to get out of that as a trend.
What are the variables that you can't control? Because like then when you mentioned about fidget spinners, I remember seeing someone on the subway the other day, the New York subway, with a Star Wars Last Jedi one. Now, how can you as a trend forecaster predict whether The Last Jedi is going to be a good film or not? Because 2 years out of its release, when it's still in pre-production, it could either be amazing and everyone will love it and it'll be, you know, everything branded Last Jedi will sell amazingly well, or it could be terrible. Yep. How can you predict that? Some variable, some pieces in the jigsaw yep. are utterly unknown to you at that
yeah.
stage.
Yeah, and I think that's absolutely right. And it's up to us, you know, we help a brand or a retailer get to a certain point, and then it's up to them who know their consumers intimately. And we do work on consulting projects where we will get to know their target audience much more intimately as well. But, you know, you can lead the horse to water to a certain extent, and we will give absolutely our best predictions to that point. But yeah, there are always going to be some things that are more successful than others.
Do you talk to your clients' customers? Because we have a client that used to be in what used to be called market research, but is now called, it's rebranded as customer centricity. It's a bit like insolvency practitioners and our business recovery experts, you know. But it's still market research. Yeah. I just hope that Charles isn't listening to this. But, you know, how much of it is actually, in a sense, good old trusty market research, knowing their brand? Because a lot of the time we found that the stronger and more meaningful a connection has a brand to its own customers, they're the best source of kind of qualitative feedback.
Yeah. Look, we our research is about what's happening in the market. And by that, I mean the market of consumers and what products that they want. That's our job. And then for a brand or one of our clients, it's their job to understand their consumers. But we try and bring those things together, because what you often find is there's a disconnect between the consumer that they want or the one that they think they've got and the ones who are actually going into their store or buying from their brand. So we help them with that as well. And I think the advantage you have when you're not the brand itself is you can take this holistic view, you can take a step back, and you're not emotionally connected, which why consulting still continues to flourish in this world, because, and you know your business inside out, often you need somebody outside of that to be able to point out either the faults but also the opportunities that might exist as well.
And who are the trendsetters these days then? If you're the trend forecaster, I mean, because in the old days it would either there'd be a television advert or a newspaper advert. Now there's online, social media, key influencers, bloggers, you know, the whole panoply of mix of people that might actually want your attention to tell you what to buy and what not to buy. There seems to be a lot more to pay attention to.
Yeah.
But who do you pay attention to?
We pay attention less to the influencers and the celebrities, although they do have an impact. They absolutely have an impact. But our job is actually to look at where real people are going and feed that in. Now, real people are obviously influenced. But, you know, let me give you a good example. When Obama was in power and he started talking about the fact that he was going to allow Americans to travel to Cuba, that was an instant signifier to us that we needed to get a team on the ground in Cuba, because if Americans were suddenly going to be travelling there in ever greater numbers, then they were going to experience new foods, they were going to see new colour combinations, they were going to experience new things. And when they came back home, they would have an expectation that they were able to get those foods or buy those colour combinations or have those experiences. So we try and get ahead of where the consumer will be going, and that's how we feed it back. Now, I think the age of the social media influencer is really interesting, but lots of those are more about manifesting a trend or introducing it. They're not necessarily, I believe, the ones setting the trends, because they're not making their own clothes. They're not, well, some of them are now creating their own beauty products, but it's the brands that are dressing them or giving them those products to wear. So we're a step ahead of that, which is thinking, well, what impact and what will the consumer want? What will the individual, what will the normal man or woman on the street want? Help the brands with that, and then they can use the influencer to get that message across.
So to some extent, you're kind of adrift on the sea of geopolitical events, some of which are foreseen and some of which aren't. I mean, for example, Brexit.
Yep.
Like most people in the world, everyone thought Remain would win. The government weren't even allowed to plan for Brexit. We worked for a prominent Brexiteer and we worked for a prominent Remainer, but the prominent Brexiteer that we worked for didn't think he was going to win. So to what extent are you kind of blindsided by things like that? And what to what extent does something like Brexit actually affect the environment that we're in, because there is a bit of a chilling effect. People seem to be a bit more morose these days.
Yeah, it's a really interesting one, and I think largely because of my background with Huffington Post and things like that, I'm very passionate about politics. But the way that we are ruled, or what will affect how we travel, or what we will have money to spend, or how much money we will have to spend on things, absolutely has an effect on the product. So we have to be very aware of it, and we have to roll with the punches. We have to roll with the changes as well. I was in France on the day of hearing the Brexit referendum results.
You're always in the theatre of war, aren't you?
I think I'm like a bad luck penny on these things, which might give you an indication as to my thoughts on the Brexit outcome. And, you know, I had a team, some of whom were very, very upset, and we had to get together and say, okay, well, what does this mean? And we were in the middle of the Cannes Lion Festival, and we were there to be reporting on marketing trends and communication trends. And we had to have a kind of, you know, state of the nation, which is, well, what does that mean for what we do? Because we are going to have our clients looking for answers as well. And we're not there.
I'm not sure there are any more answers even
now
for that day.
No, I know. And that, you know, we're not there to advise on political issues, but we are there to advise on what might this mean. And Brexit is a great example, which is, well, you know, the pound is not as valuable. It's more expensive if you're a Brit to travel to Europe, which means you're more likely to stay at home. And therefore, what impact is that going to have on the clothes that you wear? Now, we're having a beautiful summer right now, but if you're traveling and holidaying in this country, well, it doesn't tend to be quite so warm as if you were traveling to Greece or the Caribbean or somewhere like that. So what impact is that going to have on the clothes that you'll be buying this year? It's that kind of the kind of impact that these big political events can have.
And do you ever get clients, like, for example, that might have come to you 10 years ago and say, we make fax machines, do you think we should launch a beige range? Or Blockbuster Video that says, do you think we should double the number of our stores? When actually the trend that you're forecasting is, guys, you ain't going to be in business in a couple of years from now.
Yeah, and it's our job then to say to them, well, how are you going to innovate? Because there are great examples of brands that really should have gone bust now, who have seen a whole new avenue. I was in a car the other day. I was being driven back from an airport, and I noticed that the driver still had an old school sat nav, and I found that really weird. Why are you still using a sat nav?
That's outrageous.
You know, all that information is on your phone, and you look at those brands that sell sat navs. People still need to get from A to B. So what new products can you come out with? But also, if you look at all those things that really should have gone by the wayside now, like the Polaroid camera, people are still buying Polaroid cameras. Because they've reinvented that. They're very expensive. They're very cool. And people are kind of, even in a day and age where you can take the most beautiful, coolest filtered photograph with your phone, actually we've discovered that we still want to do it in an old school way.
So how do you predict things that have gone out of fashion but they're going to come back? I mean, are flared trousers going to come back?
So probably about 2 years ago, lots of brands started putting flared jeans back out.
And just they didn't. Shows you how, yeah. I mean, listeners will have to just take your word that I'm not
they
trendy.
Didn't sell.
Did they not? Right.
They didn't sell. And the reason they didn't sell, and one of my fashion experts would describe this far more eloquently than I'm going to, was because we'd got used to the fact we're all wearing flats and everyone's wearing trainers. And a flared jean doesn't work as well unless you're wearing a heel. And so the retailers who were putting these flared jeans out were not selling. You know, in some kind of more out there stores they were. But the mass wasn't ready for them again because they're wearing trainers. And so what you need to then look at is as the heel starts coming back in, then you can start experimenting with a different trouser length or shape. And you know, it's my fashion team's job, who really know this stuff, to look at those and say, actually, we're not quite ready for that. And it's about a different kind of leg at the moment. The skinny jean hasn't disappeared. That's the message to take away.
As for me, you haven't seen my legs in skinny jeans, I can assure you, and you never will. Now, can I ask you for some predictions while you're here then? Like, do you have any examples of big changes about how you think we'll live and work by, say, 2030? I know that you've talked about wearable tech becoming commonplace, for example, that's coming true. And also that there might only be specialist boutiques left on the high street. I mean, in our research for this, we have found you to have made some predictions. So can you list them?
You're going to put me on the spot. Okay, so one big shift is the fact that we are working from home far more, and that will continue to evolve. Not just because the generation of millennials have been more demanding about that work-life balance, but also because it's so expensive to live and work in big cities, which means that people don't want to, or they can't afford to, and then therefore, you know, don't want to be in the big cities. And firms need to react to that. So that's one level of it. But the level below that is, if we're not going to offices in the way that we have done before, we don't need to dress for the office. We dress for a home environment. So the rise of athleisure,
pajamas and dressing gowns, way.
But kind of not as basic as that. It is that way. So loungewear becoming far more important. Athleisure, has it peaked? Probably not, because athleisure has moved from being a trend to just being part of our normal wardrobe. So I think that's a really interesting topic. But also, you know, what does that mean for transport as well? So we're not getting the tube or the bus, we're not getting in our cars, but we're ordering everything to our houses, which mean way more delivery vehicles on the road. So it's not that the roads are going to get less congested, it's just a different kind of vehicle that's on the road. Or maybe not vehicle on the road, because the drones will start dropping off everything for us, but then lots of cities aren't going to allow that to happen. So just a simple thing, people are going to work from home, or we're going to work from home more and work in the office less. The impact that has on every aspect of our lives is exponential. And that's when I get, you can hear it in my voice, so excited about what we do, because it's not the cliche of the possibilities are endless. It's the possibilities and scenarios that every business needs to take into account. Because not only should you now be thinking, if you're a clothing retailer, well, what mix you've got in your store, but you've also got to think about, well, how are you going to get people somewhere to design those clothes and sell those clothes, because people are going to be working from home. So I think that's one big prediction. The other for me is our changing attitudes towards food. Veganism is on the rise, for health reasons and environmental reasons as well.
And for fluffy animal welfare reasons, I'm a vegan.
And fluffy animal welfare. Well, I'm dabbling in it. Having been a vegetarian for years and years, I'm pretty much a vegan during the week now.
If you looked at milk under a microscope, you would never have dairy again.
Dairy, that's not so much the stuff. It's just, you know, a nice little seared tuna steak on the barbecue at the weekend, but just now and again. But, so the impact that has on what we want in restaurants, the impact that has on the takeaway food we have, the impact that has on the things that we're going to get from our supermarkets. But also, if you know, if you're investing in a firm right now, well, I'd be thinking about, you know, the vegan cheese industry that's there, and the great work that's happening in Silicon Valley and other places about meat substitutes, which are more ethical, more environmentally friendly, and will lure people who just can't imagine giving up meat over to this new way of eating. So I think that's really interesting. And I have to say, I was walking up a little side street in London the other day past a pretty old school pub, and on the blackboard outside, our new vegan menu. And that's when you know something is tipping from a trend into a kind of mass market change, and a movement, we would call it, that will become, you know, common in everyday life.
I mean, we don't work with any brands with a huge retail estate, so I'm not an expert on this. I'm the man on the Clapham Omnibus, but I don't need to be a trend forecaster to know that these huge retail brands are in trouble. I mean, almost daily there's some big big retail brand with a big retail estate that's having to close because they haven't either embraced online sufficiently, or the fact it's just not economic to have stores. I mean, is this going to be just specialist boutiques from now on? Because you look at these big brands, and is anyone even going in store anymore?
I think what's interesting is, if you walk along, let's take Oxford Street, you know, one of the busiest shopping streets in the world, there are still millions of people going down that street. It's just our expectation of what we get in a store is very different. Now, again, it's a bit of a cliche. You know, I've written about it. Many people smarter than me have written about it. You know, the age of experience, the store is an experience space. And I think that the reason lots of people have written about it is there's a huge truth to that as well. We still want a connection with brands. Otherwise, why would Amazon be opening stores? Why would innovative brands like Glossier, a great example of a, you know, millennial first brand, direct consumer brand, opening store space? We still like to interact with those brands, but if we want something, we want to be able to get it quickly, and we want it ordered to our door or our desk. Basically, we want it ordered to wherever we might be. And I think it's the brands who've recognised that there is still a place for brand in this world and a relationship with that brand, but the high demands of a consumer as to how they get the product. And if you can put those things together, then I think there will still be stores. Will there still be those colossal, huge spaces, you know, the out-of-town type thing? it's not going to exist in the same way that it does today. But then look, I'm someone who bought a property this year and bought an awful lot of stuff from John Lewis, and I went in store and I looked at the washing machine and then I ordered it online and had it delivered to my door. And I guess I'm kind of old fashioned in that way now. But let's see what, you know, the Gen Zs that are coming through now, their expectation there. You know, my brother, who's a firm millennial, you know, he hasn't picked up a piece of print media ever. And he does all his shopping online. But he, you know, he still goes into a store now and again, but he goes into it for a very different reason.
Our offices are in North Soho, very near Oxford Street, actually. And I was introduced to the concept of showrooming about 10 years ago, quite a long time ago, when I was in HMV. And I saw someone pick up a DVD box set, and then they were using the Amazon app to scan in the barcode. I mean, clearly, it seems to me like brands like WH Smith, for example, are, you know, where they've got a kind of almost too generic catch-all offer. If they don't specialise, that they run the serious risk of going the way of, you know, even Toys R Us, Woolies, etc.
I think there's the being a specialist in something, I think, is one way to survive in this. Absolutely. There is being a generalist that either does customer service better than anyone else, does price better than anyone else, or does breadth of choice better than anyone else. I mean, if you can do all of those, you're absolutely onto a winner. But we like to hear from experts as well. And, you know, that comes back to that John Lewis example. If I can go in and someone is really going to help me get the best washing machine for my needs. I'm sorry, I'm talking about a very unsexy topic here, but, you know, one that hopefully resonates with lots of people, then I will go to them because they're an expert in that. But they're selling quite a broad range of things.
But might you scan that barcode in at John Lewis on the Amazon app and see that it was cheaper, say 30 quid cheaper via Amazon rather than, say, John Lewis online?
And I would definitely do that price comparison. And I think because of John Lewis's price promise, that's another reason that they've been really successful there. But yeah, let's make no bones about it. Price absolutely comes into it. But people are also prepared to pay more now because of the credentials of a brand, because of its environmental ethics, because of its human ethics. But also if they think that they're going to get something different. And I think that's, you know, in a world when I'm talking passionately about trends here and the right trends, people also want to find uniqueness within that. And that's our job also to spot that as a trend and who are going to be the kind of tastemakers in that. And I think people will pay for those things.
Now, you did 15 years in journalism. We're going to talk about that in a second. But just as a kind of bridge, let's do it backwards in a sense. How did you end up moving from journalism into this? Because it's not the traditional career path for someone as a high-flying journalist like your good self.
I think my entire career, it hasn't been well thought out or particularly strategic.
Mine certainly hasn't.
But I love learning new things. And I think probably looking back, whenever I've got very comfortable in a role, I've started looking for something new. And when they approached me about the job at WGSN, I mean, it took me a long time to decide that that was the right move for me. But I was ready to learn something new. And I've learned all sorts of new things coming over here. But I also think it's an interesting time. You know, it was always, you know, B2C was where, you know, you wanted to be in consumer media. And yet the B2B media world is really having a moment right now. I think it's probably the most exciting place in media. And it's a place where, you know, people are still making money and they're investing because we're helping companies make really strategic business decisions. And I find that absolutely fascinating. So the short answer is to learn something new. But there's, you know, there's many layers below that.
I'm sure there is. So would you describe WGSN as a media company?
We fall under that bracket. I think we're pretty unique, but then I would say that we're a trend forecasting company, and that's what we do. And we offer business insights, and we help people make great product decisions. But you know, we'll be at the PPA Awards in a couple of weeks' time, and we're up for, you know, best business media brand. So certain people definitely categorise us that way.
Tell us about your journalism career. We might as well continue this trend. There you are, working backwards. How many years were you at the Huffington Post for? Because you launched it, of course.
Yeah, I did. So I was there for 3.5 years.
Wow, I bet they were incredibly exciting times.
It was. It was amazing. It was a phenomenal opportunity to be given. And it was at a time when, you know, we were one of the first, and amazing brands have come along since then, like BuzzFeed.
HuffPost's still a strong brand, in my view.
Still a strong brand. I mean, I'd always loved Huffington Post. Back in my Marie Claire days, if we had a, you know, an editor's meeting and I was short of ideas, I'd log on to the Huffington Post and there would definitely be a new idea there that we should be reporting on. And so I was at AOL and the announcement came out that we were going to purchase Huffington Post. And it's well documented. I've talked about it quite a lot, but I tracked down Arianna Huffington and said, look, I love this brand and I want to launch it in the UK. And it was 3.5 years. It was hard work. My goodness, it was hard work. And we were this small disruptor brand. I think there were only about 20 of us at the very beginning. And we grew that during my time there. About probably far less than 20 on day one. I think it was probably about 6 of us on day one.
Incredibly proactive of you, though, to actually find and seek out Arianna Huffington and then, you know, create that job for yourself.
Yeah. And again, I've been asked about, you know, is this a sign of, you know, you should go for what you want? There wasn't even time really to think about that. I was standing Barnsbridge Station, the email from Tim Armstrong, the CEO of AOL, came through, we're buying Huffington Post, and the 20-something minute journey to Waterloo, I'd Googled her email address and I'd fired off that email. And it was one of those, I loved that brand. I thought it was phenomenal. I didn't really think about it more than, oh my goodness, it's going to be part of our company. And therefore, if it's coming to the UK, then I'm going to be damn sure that I'm the one who brings it here. And as anyone who's ever worked for Arianna Huffington will tell you, she's incredibly proactive as well. She picked up my email, responded immediately. And I think we spoke later that week. And, you know, it was only a matter of months later. The deal hadn't gone through then. I don't think we were probably supposed to be speaking. And a matter of months later, I met her and you know, kind of the rest is history to a certain extent.
And what are your main memories of those 3.5 years?
My goodness. I was really lucky. We had this young team who were super passionate and everybody did everything. And that summer, I had said to Arianna, there is no point launching a news and politics site at the beginning of the summer in Europe. In the UK, nothing will happen. I was so unbelievably wrong on every single level. We had the London riots that year and just news story after news story was breaking. It was the summer of the phone hacking saga. And we were, you know, we were attempting to cover all of those. And one of those memories was very sad news. Amy Winehouse had died. And my politics editor, who was on shift, we were a very small team, my politics editor jumped on it. I mean, everybody did until we got hold of the entertainment editor and then she came on and, you know, wrote the stories. But it was a real, everyone, you know, rolled their sleeves up, got their hands dirty, did everything that they needed to. It was very lacking in hierarchy because all of us who were there were determined that we were going to make it a success. And I think that's, you know, I was so proud to play any small part in that.
But in any kind of localised franchise, as it were, like, for example, if you're in France and you buy a McDonald's franchise, you've got to pick and choose the bits that you want to replicate and the bits that you want to localise. So in a French McDonald's, you can get a beer. You know, they put mayonnaise on the chips, and I could quote Pulp Fiction endlessly. But did you have a kind of existential kind of 2-hour meeting where you kind of threw a basketball around and said, we'll keep that bit of what's working and then we'll localise this bit? How did that actually work?
Yeah, and there were topics, you know, there were discussions that took place, which is, well, you know, celebrity in this era, entertainment in this area, you know, that could all be covered from the US. But, you know, they don't have EastEnders and they have a different take on it. But what was really interesting, actually, was the US entertainment team became very interested in all our soap stories. They loved those as well. But yeah, you know, Brits and Americans, divided by a common language, you have to have a different take on it. And, you know, we're not going to cover their presidential elections in the way that they would. So there was a really good acknowledgement that we would have to do things from a UK perspective because it was going to be HuffPost UK. And when all the other international editions came along, all of that was thought through as well. And also, what are the things that are going to be really important to our readers? What are the topics that are going to be really important? One of the things that I think people were quite surprised about, actually, was how Brits took to the blogging platform as well.
I blogged for years on.
Oh, there you go. And but I think there was a thought, shall we say, that maybe Brits wouldn't be quite so comfortable in giving their opinions across. And I mean, absolutely, that was not the case. Everyone had something to say, and they were really happy to have an avenue to say it.
I mean, in hindsight, that seems ridiculous to think that, of course, but yeah, with the gift of hindsight, yes, but back then it was quite a brave decision.
It really was. But then you look now, and you know, having Interpost has obviously gone through big changes since my day. And, you know, the blogging platform doesn't even exist on the US site, but they have kept an aspect of it on the UK one. And I think that's, you know, it's a sign of an organisation that's prepared to be aware of and embrace the localities, you know, and the nuances in a global platform. And, you know, bring it back to WGSN. As I said, we've got clients across the globe. We have to realise that someone who's creating shoes in Australia might need something very different to someone who's creating an amazing hotel experience in the US. And being able to kind of pick through those cultural nuances and the localised version of that, while also acknowledging that we live in a hyper-connected world that's smaller than ever, and therefore we know, or we think we know, what's going on in other countries and what we might want from that as well.
When you go on HuffPost now, do you see some of your old decisions and your old things there? Or is it a bit like, you know, when you split from a relationship and you have to unfollow your ex on Instagram because you don't want to kind of go back there? And it's no disrespect or slight on them, but you kind of have to move on.
I very much had to move on, mainly because it wasn't so much a relationship. It felt like it was my baby and someone was going to be bringing up my baby in totally the wrong way. And if I logged on, it would be like, oh, I'm not sure why they've done that image or why that headline. So I had to break with HuffPost for a while before I could go back and read it and enjoy it as any other user of that site.
There doesn't seem to be any right or wrong answer to that, because we've had quite a few editors and former editors, and they say, you know, some say I can still read it and enjoy it as a reader now, and others say I can never ever look at it again because I'll want to know why that was done, and, you know, I'll just feel utterly powerless. Like Superman was in Superman 2, you know, when he had his powers taken away from him.
Yeah. It was my life for 3.5 years, and therefore, yeah, it was difficult. It was difficult to leave it. But also, I think with any, you know, and I'm not the founder of Huffington Post, Arianna Huffington and the team at that time, but I brought it here, and because of that, felt very emotionally connected to it. But I also think, you know, no one is irreplaceable. Nobody is. Even founders of amazing companies are not irreplaceable. And it was great to give someone else an opportunity, and just like it was WGSN, to bring me in someone with a, you know, a new take on that. And that's how companies remain successful. You know, you bring in new ideas.
Now, you were a former editor of Marie Claire Online and deputy editor of Condé Nast's Glamour.com. Were there many women at that time playing a leading role in digital?
I think I've been phenomenally lucky because I've had amazing female bosses and amazing male bosses my entire career. But when I went to Condé Nast, I was in the digital division. We were actually called Condé Net back then.
Oh, that's
yeah.
I can't. It's like something out of Nathan Barley,
yeah,
isn't it?
Condé Net. And we were on the 7th floor of Vogue House. The lift only went up to the 6th floor. I'm fairly sure most people within Condé Nast didn't even know there was a 7th floor.
And wow, but that added to the mystique, actually. I quite like that now.
Yeah. So you came out of the lift and you had to, you know, fight your way through a few magazines and then up this little staircase which had a fire escape sign on it and up to the 7th floor, and had an amazing female editor-in-chief, Abigail Chisman, who taught a whole generation of young journalists what this digital world was. And, you know, we were in our mid to late 20s being headhunted by every other publishing firm who suddenly all woke up and thought, oh my God, we probably need a website. Which publishing firm actually has websites for their magazines? Condé Nast. And so, you know, many people went on and did amazing things after that. But we learnt it all on the 7th floor of Vogue House.
How did you get into journalism then, given that we've started at the present and worked backwards? Tell us about what's the origin story?
The origin story is I just wanted to write. I loved writing. I think I flirted when I was 13 with wanting to be a vet and then went on a French exchange and saw two rabbits skinned and decided maybe that career wasn't for me, and so, yeah, pretty much at the precocious age of 13, when I decided I wasn't going to be a vet, I decided I wanted to be a writer. And if I wanted to be a writer and have a career, then journalism was what I wanted to do. And so I ran the newsletter at school, and then the minute I got to university, I signed up for the student newspaper and worked my way up and became editor of the Warwick Boar.
Wow! What was your goal at that point? Were you going to kind of be Woodward and Bernstein investigative reporter, or were you going to be editor of the Daily Telegraph? What was your ambition at that point?
I loved women's magazines, and I wanted to work in features on women's magazines. But I think I also thought secretly that I'd probably be the editor of Guardian one day. That didn't work out quite that way. I loved writing, and I liked features. I liked the fact that you could get totally immersed in a story. So that's where I saw myself going. And I really fell into digital. I'd done lots of work experience at women's magazines, so Cosmopolitan and places like that. And then a great woman called Erin Kelly, who was at Cosmo, bizarrely hadn't been there when I'd done work experience, but I'd sat at her desk and I diligently sent her a thank you for letting me sit at your desk. And we stayed in contact, and I used to help her out with stories. So she used to write for More Magazine and Cosmo and places like that. So I'd help her find case studies of sex-starved students at university. And she moved on, and she was working at Condé Nast and sent me an email one day saying there's a job board up and there's a ad posted on it for a writer on Condé Nast's website. I think you'd be great for it. And that's how I ended up in digital journalism.
But interestingly there, you said you wanted to be a writer, but you also imagined yourself being editor of The Guardian. So were you always quite ambitious? Did you always want to move beyond writing into a kind of managerial type, leadership type role? Was that always part of the ambition? Because the more leadership and management stuff you do, the less writing you're going to do. We've had a few editors on here, like Chris Blackhurst said when he was made editor of The Independent. He said it was within about a week the novelty had worn off and he hated it. He said it was all HR and spreadsheets and he wanted to get back to writing.
I like being in charge.
I do as well. But you've got, how many staff have you got? 300?
Yeah, 350, 400, something
wow.
like that.
That's like literally like 20 times more than me.
Do you know what? There was a real tipping point for me quite recently, actually. I was asked to comment on Christopher Bailey at Burberry. And it was about 6 months after he'd been made CEO. And the company performance numbers were out. And I was asked to comment on why he, as creative director, couldn't make it as CEO. And it made me so angry because I don't think just because you are a creative doesn't mean that you can be a great business person. In fact, I think creatives make some of the best business people. I think probably what was difficult for Christopher Bailey was being both at once. Those are two humongous jobs, and to do both of them well is difficult. Although, let's face it, he was pretty damn successful in the grand scheme of things. And it was that, it really kind of resonated with me personally, that I wanted to prove in my own way that you can be a brilliant creative and you can also lead a business, which has probably led me onto the path of, you know, becoming MD at WGSN. But track it back, I was passionate about writing. I knew I wanted to be a journalist, but I've always been very ambitious. And therefore, you know, the step up was then to move into an editor role.
And do you think you're born with those leadership goals or not? Because I've always ran my own business. I started my first business when I was 17. I've never had a job. I often think, one of my clients once said to me that leadership is like the clap. You've either got it or you haven't, which I think is actually quite unfair because you can learn a lot. You know, a lot of my colleagues and friends have done MBAs, for example. Yeah, that was a terrible analogy, wasn't it?
But he did say that. Yeah, I remember that one.
But, you know, it's an ancient cliche question, but whether leaders are born or made, is it a gene? Is it something you have in you? Or is it something that you can cultivate? Because it sounds to me like me, you've always wanted, you've always had that ambition.
You'd have to ask my team, I think. Am I a good leader or not? I as I said, I've been very lucky to have amazing bosses and amazing leaders. Actually, I think the two are slightly different as well. But I'm very passionate. I've been very passionate about everywhere I've worked. I think that's why I've been at those places, and I wouldn't have gone to them if I didn't have that passion for it. And I think if you can ignite that in the people that work for you, you are halfway there. And yeah, you can read books and you can do courses. And I have crises of confidence every single day that I'm not doing the best job that I can as the leader of my organisation.
Just once a day. It's every hour for me, on the hour as well. I set an alarm.
Well, but I want to do good for my organisation. And I want my team to come along with me on that. And
it's contagious, isn't
yeah.
it? The enthusiasm.
Yeah.
You can't fake it, really.
No.
I think that's part of being a good leader.
And I look back on the people I've worked for, and the best have always been those ones who led from the front, who lived and breathed what they did. And I wanted to be on that journey with them. Even if I didn't agree with them all the time, I wanted to be on that journey with them.
So what type of leader are you? And what is a typical week for you at the moment? And you're not allowed to say there is no typical week, because I say that and there is.
A typical week probably does involve travelling to one of our offices. So we've got 14 different offices around the world. So China, Sao Paulo, Hong Kong, you know, the list goes on.
A lot of air miles then.
A lot of air miles.
A lot of airline food as well.
No, I don't do airline food. Yeah. I spend a lot of money in Pret just before I get on the plane.
Clever.
I'm one of those really annoying people that kind of arrives with like bags and bags of food because I need to be fed during those journeys.
Well, it's just all salt and sugar, isn't it, in airline food?
Can't do it. So yes, a typical week will involve travel of some description, probably to one of our offices. It will absolutely involve meeting with a client at least one a week, probably a lot more, especially if I'm on the ground somewhere, because you don't improve your business or the product, whatever it is, and our product is our platform, unless you are listening to what your customers want. So I do that a lot. And then also going and learning something new. So going to a conference and hearing amazing speakers, reading things. I'm still a voracious reader, online and print. I still buy print.
Curiosity is such a huge part of being a leader.
Yeah. And also, I don't think we can be good at what we're doing in terms of forecasting if we're not looking at everything that's going on. So speaking to brilliant people and learning from them and downloading their brains and making sure I can use that not only in our business, but also in the business that we sell on. And lots of internal meetings as well, one-to-ones with my team, brainstorms with my team. I'm part of Essential, so we've got Cannes Lions as a sister brand there, Money 2020 as a sister brand there. So usually spending some time with our sister and brother brands to work out how we can, you know, collaborate. And we do an awful lot of that at the moment.
And what's top of your to-do list at the moment in terms of the medium and long term? I know that you're on the record of saying you want taxi drivers to know what WGSN is. You know, are you getting there? I mean, appearing on this podcast is great, but we don't have many taxi drivers, I don't think.
I use the taxi driver aim because in my very early days at Huffington Post, I would get into taxi and taxi driver always asked, what do you do for a living? And journalist, fine, editor of the Huffington Post, and no one had a clue what I was talking about. And 3.5 years later, I could pretty much get into any taxi. What did you, editor of the Huffington Post? Oh, yes, I heard one of your team on the radio the other day. Now, WGSN is very different. Probably we're not going to be forecasting for taxi drivers. But for me, it's about, I think maybe my ambition there has changed, and it's more about helping as many businesses as possible be successful. Because when it happens, the feedback and the joy and the great kind of business movements that we can activate with what we do, that's everything. That really is everything. And that's where I want us to get. You know, we're in over 100 countries. We should be in over 200 countries. We're forecasting for 23 different industries. We could be forecasting for 50 industries. What's interesting is really looking at the emerging markets and where they can really use our expertise and educating people on trend. And that's really exciting. You know, the sky's the limit on that front.
And given the niche that you're in, it sounds to me like, you know, the sky's the limit in terms of opportunities. It's not as if you're going to open a fish and chip shop over the road from an existing fish and chip shop where your only hope for growth is actually increase market share. In other words, stealing your competitors' customers.
It's a niche industry, but it's an industry that can impact on every other industry. And I think that's what's fascinating. And from 20 years ago, just selling to the fashion world, the number of industries now that proactively come to us who are saying, wow, you know, in a world where everyone has so much data and you can buy as much data as you want, how do you get the actual actionable insights from that? And how do you really work out what people are going to want? Well, people are the best experts on that front. And that's why I'm so kind of confident about our future.
You are right, though, about in terms of having too much data in a sense. So, for example, this podcast, I know how many listeners that we have overall. Our hosting company will tell us the geographical location, the device listened to, average listens, entry point, you know, URL, blah, blah, blah. But actually, you end up almost none the wiser. You can really do a deep dive for an hour and think, wow, I know so much. And then you think, actually, I know nothing. It's a bit like the old cliche again, price of everything, value of nothing.
Yeah, and I think that's really what we're seeing. And as I said, we do use big data. You know, data is an important part of our forecasting, but data for data's sake is useless. And that's why, you know, big technology firms, big data firms use us because they want someone to kind of cut through all those numbers and say, ah, that one over there, actually, that's the one you should be looking at. And it might be one of the smallest, because it's those little signifiers that will signify or manifest change in the future. And, you know, that's what you need to know. Well, who should I have on next? Well, is there some small, you know, cool zine that Gen Z are obsessed with at the moment that might not have a mass readership, but the person behind that, fascinating. What are they doing? What can they impart to people? And that's genuinely why I think trend forecasting is so fascinating.
It is, which is why I've, you know, A, had you on, and B, you know, asked you so many questions about it. I don't expect you to answer this, but what's next for you personally? I appreciate you're going to say that you're happy now and that you're not looking. That's the stock answer. But, you know, tell us the truth. Are you secretly on the lookout? Do you have a secret? I mean, it sounds to me ferociously ambitious. Do you have an evil master plan toward global domination that you're going to advance to the next stage on in a couple of years?
I do have an evil master plan for world domination, but I would like WGSN to be dominating the world. I was made MD in January, a big step up for me, and I'm very proud to be given the opportunity to lead this company, which clearly I adore.
Because you were chief content officer before then, were you, for 4 years?
So I started about 3.5 years. That's wow. Usually my tenure, 3.5 years in a job, and then I need something new, and MD was the something new. So I'm learning new things. I'm looking at a lot more Excel spreadsheets than I was before. But crucially, I understand what we create, which is amazing content. So, you know, it comes back to my Christopher Bailey story. I'm hopefully here to prove that a good creative, blowing my trumpet, but good creative can also be a good business leader.
Carla, that's been incredibly interesting. Thank you ever so much for your time.
No, thank you so much for having me on. It's been genuinely a pleasure.
A Right Angles podcast in association with Big Things Media.